and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubinstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. On today's episode, I'm joined by Jackie Gifford, the editor-in-chief of America's biggest travel magazine, Travel and Leisure, or as they would say, Travel and Leisure. So let me tell you a little bit first about why I was so excited when Jackie agreed to come on the podcast. I'm half American, and every school holiday we'd fly to the US to visit my family in Miami. And on every trip, I'd go with my parents to Barnes & Noble, which is a bookstore there, and I'd pick up the biggest pile of American magazines. There was just something so exotic, so exciting about how they looked and smelt. The covers were different, they were a different size, the ads were for things we couldn't get at home in England, and I'd spend all my pocket money and read them by the pool. And one of the magazines that I'd always buy was Travel and Leisure. So it's one of the magazines that I followed for the longest time, given that I'm getting on a bit these days. And it always inspired me with its incredible covers and moving features. And Jackie, who's at the helm now, will absolutely inspire you with this episode. It is chock full of travel inspo. Lots of destinations that haven't been talked about on the podcast before, which I always love. And Jackie herself has lived all around the world, so she's a destination expert on so many great places. So it's no surprise then that this is a long-haul, feature-length episode, and I can't wait for you to hear it. From Anguilla and Mexico to Bermuda and Puglia, speaking to me from New York City, here are the Travel Diaries of Travel and Leisure's editor-in-chief, Jackie Gifford. Jackie Gifford, welcome to the Travel Diaries. Thank you so much for joining me today, all the way from New York. How are you?
I am so well. Thank you for having me. I think, look, in this new world of virtual everything, it's kind of brilliant to be able to connect with people and talk to them. And I find I'm actually talking to new friends like I never have before. So thank you again for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's a real honor to get to chat to you.
Thank you. Oh, I'm so thrilled. You know, next year, Travel and Leisure celebrates its 50th anniversary, which I find pretty amazing. And we're a brand that continues to change and evolve and grow as we look to Instagram and now TikTok and all these other amazing ways to reach people. So look, I'm really proud of our brand and everybody who works for us.
So I don't want to dwell too long on COVID, because frankly, we've all had enough of it, really.
But tell me about it.
So you're based in New York City, yeah. And you edit a travel magazine. So how have the last few months been for you?
They've been challenging. You know, I would never try to minimize the disruption or sadness that has occurred because of this virus. I moved my team to work remotely in the middle of March. We worked downtown in the financial district, and you know, it caught me by surprise. All of a sudden everything just escalated. I'd say that first 2 weeks of March, and travel restrictions started happening, and we moved everybody to work from home, made sure people were healthy. And the good news is we have now closed sixth magazine from afar. And I just am amazed by the resilience of the travel industry, my team. We had to come up with an editorial strategy that really felt solid and true. And I think what we're doing is we're still running some of the content that we had commissioned before the coronavirus. And that's really because, look, people often take 2-3 years to plan a trip. So they're thinking ahead and they will be able to travel someday. And then we're also speaking to this new world of travel. Like I just mentioned, the world of virtual travel. We did a great piece in that first issue that came out about museums, how to visit museums from wherever you are, from the comfort of your home. And I think ultimately, our readers are very forgiving. They know that when you close a magazine, things change, but they still dream about the future. And then with our website and on Instagram, we're just keeping the dream alive and also providing up-to-the-minute news and letting people know what is happening in the world of travel, whether it's airlines or cruise lines and you know, border closures. And that is sort of feeding the actual news, the news content, and making sure that people know. Because, you know, in the United States, they are traveling. We're traveling within our home states. We're sometimes traveling to different states if, you know, people are doing a lot of road trips this summer. So I think what we're doing right now is just making sure people feel inspired and hopeful, because they come to Travel and Leisure to dream. They don't come to us for, I'd say, the hard news and frankly, the sad news. But New York is resilient. I'm a New Yorker. It's my tag on my Instagram handle. I believe in New York City. I get very defensive and protective of my home city because, you know, it was a very challenging time for us, that for those of us who stayed, I stayed and didn't leave. And, you know, we had amazing healthcare workers, frontline workers, just keeping the city going. So frankly, I believe in New York. You never want to count New York out. I believe in London. I believe in all of our major cities. We shouldn't, we shouldn't be afraid of them, because they're beautiful places.
And I saw that you took your first staycation relatively recently. I think it was the same weekend that I took my first staycation.
Oh, fun. Yeah.
I went just outside of London to the Cotswolds, which is about an hour and a half from there, which is a gorgeous place to have a little staycation and dip my toe in the water of seeing what hospitality is like in the new normal. And for me, it was a really pleasant surprise. It didn't feel too different. I didn't feel that it was too much of a shock to the system. In fact, I almost forgot that we were in a pandemic in a way. How was your experience?
I felt the same. It reaffirmed my faith in travel and that we can do things right. Again, New York State was one of the hardest. It was the first and hardest hit state. So,
yeah, of course.
But we pulled it together, and the infection rates are now some of the lowest in the country. And what I did, so my husband is from Long Island. And, you know, Long Island is obviously so close to Manhattan. We drove. We didn't bring our son to the hotel. We didn't want to have to really worry about that. But it was a very small hotel, 15 rooms. Everybody wore masks. Then I'm talking about the guests and the people who work there. They had sanitizing stations everywhere. They hit for hands. They had the tables all spaced out appropriately. We were blessed with great weather, so we were able to sit outside. You know, you could bring a bottle of wine and sit on some chairs and take your mask off to enjoy the wine. They had a chef come and cook dinners on the grill for some of the guests. So it wasn't like a formal restaurant experience, but you could have a meal outdoors. And again, all the tables were spaced out, and they had these amazing things called Yupang sterilizers. I keep talking about them. There are these machines that, frankly, you can throw your remote control keys, even your phone, in there, and it kills any, you know, virus particles on the surface. Wow. And every room had one. So I think there was a benefit in that, and every room had its own entrance. There was a benefit in that it was a small hotel. There was a lot that we were doing outdoors, and we walked to the beach for beach days. So it helps to be outdoors. And I'm looking to do my first stay in Manhattan in the coming weeks, and I'm going to report on that. You know, I think we have to remember that we're journalists, and the world of travel is opening, and it is our responsibility to communicate to our readers what that's like. And so, you know, I'm not saying I'm throwing myself out there as a guinea pig. I'm choosing places that I believe are doing things right, and then trying to see what the experience is like so we can inform our audience, because that is our responsibility now as a travel brand, is to be truthful and tell people what protocols are now in place. And frankly, you know, that is one of the hardest things I find right now about this job, is that there's no consistent through line, right? So wherever you are in the world, wherever you may be, the virus has changed destinations in different ways. So as we look to sort of educate our audience, we have to really be thoughtful and careful. And so we're doing the best we can.
Yeah. Well, listen, I can't wait to hear all about your travel diaries, because really you've had a truly international life, having lived all over the world.
Yeah, I have. I was born in Japan. I lived in Saudi Arabia, Qatar. I lived in the United States for some of my earliest years in the Philadelphia area, in Bucks County. And my parents now live in Philadelphia, so we often go back. But I lived in Japan twice, actually. So we were able to travel to places as a family when travel really to I would say Asia, to Africa, certainly was not really in the cards for many Americans, because it was so far away. So my mother was always of the mindset to travel, to take advantage of our location. So when we lived in Saudi Arabia, we were able to go to the Maldives, and that's crazy to even say, but we went in 1983.
Wow.
We went to Kenya. When we lived in Japan, you know, my parents often would take us to Hong Kong, and we did Thailand, and my mom and dad went diving in Palau. We went to, she actually visited China. One of the first, she was, you know, back then really nobody was visiting China. Certainly not from a leisure travel standpoint. So she went as by herself, and you know, they were really adventurous because they always knew, you know, the United States will be there. You will likely spend most of your adult life in the United States. And they were right. And I think now it's actually really fascinating to think about it because, you know, being here in the United States and not having the freedom to jump on a plane like I used to, I am staying in the United States, and I'm looking at all the places I can go close to home, mm-hmm. with fresh eyes, which is great. As we all are, yeah. And then I'm also feeling fortunate that I was able to see so many amazing places when I lived over there, and then through my job. So I think you have to adapt to the times and the era. And right now, you know, it's close to home, and you just appreciate the beauty in that.
So let's get started with chapter one of your travel diaries. That is your earliest childhood travel memory. Sounds like you had a lot of wonderful experiences at a young age. So what sticks out?
You know, I did. And I think, you know, I have snippets of little things. I have to say, if there's one sort of place that really I hold on to as a childhood travel memory, it's probably Kauai, the island of Kauai, and just Hawaii as a state. And that's for a variety of reasons. You know, when we lived in Japan, we would often go to Hawaii as a stopover on our way home, to the East Coast. And Hawaii, you know, it's America, but it's not. It's all the things that people say it is. The culture is fascinating. The people are, you know, very warm, and it's when you're there, you feel like, you know, time slows down in a really beautiful way. And we would, for whatever reason, you know, all the Hawaiian islands had a different feel or vibe. And my mother really loved Kauai. She felt it's, you know, it had a different soul, I would say. And it's called the Garden Isle. It's one of the, you know, the luscious, the greenest of the islands. And we would often go to the South Shore, which is actually the sunniest part, for vacations, and then take day trips up to the North Shore, which is where they filmed Jurassic Park. You have those amazing cliffs. It's the, you know, the gorgeous Nepali coast is part of Kauai. So I think, you know, when I think back to an early childhood memory, it was just packing up our rental car with a cooler. We would often, you know, not really stay in hotels, but rent like a home or something like that, and try to stay for several weeks. And we would pack up coolers, make sandwiches, go to the beach, and just bring our own beach towels. You know, obviously in Hawaii, all the beaches there are public, which I think is really amazing. So you can, you know, any public access beach, we would just go and visit, and we would tick off the beaches that we would see over the course of the trip, and get to try different restaurants. And I, you know, and then we go back year after year, and I haven't been for a long time. And that makes me, you know, it makes me fond, and this, even talking about it, makes me nostalgic for those simpler times.
Yeah. Oh, it's my favorite Hawaiian island too, actually. It's just so varied, isn't it? The island from one shore to the other. It's just so stunning.
Yeah. I love Waimea Canyon. I have a picture of my husband and I. So that's an interesting part of it that comes full circle. When my husband and I first started dating, I took him to Kauai. We went on a, he had never been. And I have a picture of us, you know, we're probably 23, 24, standing in front of Waimea Canyon. And, you know, you forget that that's the Grand Canyon of the Hawaiian Islands. It's absolutely stunning. And I can't wait to get back when it's safe to go.
So you mentioned that you lived in Japan twice. So you were born in Japan and then you moved back there.
I did.
Is that right?
I did.
Yeah. So it's a hugely popular destination mentioned by my guests on the podcast. One of the all-time favorites that always comes up, mainly I think because it feels like such a culture shock for visitors. It feels so different from what my primarily British guests are used to. Is that how you describe it when you?
I think so.
For new visitors?
Yeah, I think there's a, well, you know, when when I talk about Japan, I think oftentimes people, there's Tokyo and then there's the rest of Japan too, right? So it's like, you know, the sort of the urban, the stimulation of Tokyo is something else, right? I lived in Tokyo twice. So when we lived there, it was in the early 80s and then the early 90s. And, you know, Tokyo is a sprawling, sprawling city. If you kind of think of Manhattan and New York and how concentrated everything is, Tokyo, by contrast, it's like, it's vast. It's a vast city, vastly different neighborhoods. And as an expat living there, my school was outside the city, and it would take us an hour. It was close to an hour and a half on the bus to go each way.
Wow.
To get to our school, because there, you know, with the school that I went to, the American school, the campus, and that's with traffic, the campus was, you know, very, they needed space. And so when you think about Tokyo and how vast it is, that's the one thing that I think is so impressive, but also just the sheer energy and the amount of people that live there and the sort of formality of Japanese culture. And when you ride the subway or the metro and or the train and that, all that, like, you know, there's somebody there standing to make sure that people get on safely. And, you know, and the food and the innovation, I'd say, in terms of, you can just do some just fascinating stuff in Tokyo. You know, I remember when I was a kid living there, you know, you could get anything you wanted out of a vending machine. I'm like, serious. It's kind of fascinating, but literally anything you could ever want, you'd get out of a vending machine. And just the variety of travel experiences, I think people are drawn to, they're drawn to everything. The Japanese have a system of perfecting, I'd say, even, you know, the most, the most French food out there is the croissant, right? The classic croissant. I can honestly say some of the best croissants I've ever had are at the Peninsula Tokyo Hotel, because there's this like way of artistry. So there's Tokyo. And then I think when you get outside and see rural Japan, and of course go to Kyoto for the sort of historic aspect of Japanese culture, people are really, again, blown away by the artistry, the attention to detail, the reverence for, I think there's a really deep reverence for elders and tradition, which people enjoy there when they visit. I love Japan. My last trip there was in 2015. And it had been a long time since I had gone. And I was pleasantly surprised to find that it was still just as fascinating as it had always been. People will always enjoy the cultural aspects of Japan and just being, you know, learning. I think the person who goes has a real deep appreciation of learning and isn't going to just sit on a beach. And that's just a different kind of trip.
Outside of the tourist hotspots, Tokyo and Kyoto, is there a place that you'd say that is a must visit spot for a traveler in Japan, big or small, just outside of those two main destinations?
Yeah, I think people are, well, you know, we had actually been looking at different, you know, trips. I think people end up going to Tokyo and Kyoto for like their first visit, and then they go back and do another trip and do something interesting. I've actually never been, but I've always wanted to go to Okinawa and experience. I talk about saying not going to a beach destination, but the islands there and some of the resort experiences, I think people would be pleasantly surprised I don't think it's a first time visitor's trip to Japan, but understanding the culture there, I think, is really important. I also think people,
is that a coastal resort?
It's coastal resorts, different island groups, you know, it's far because it's farther south. People have to fly first into Tokyo and then take another plane. But I think people would be interested in experiencing that. Again, it's not maybe a first time visit to Japan. I think Seto Uchi, that area, the Seto Inland Sea, I think that's another interesting part of Japan. There's a big contemporary art festival that's held there, which attracts visitors. Also, I think in general, when people visit Japan, they think of cherry blossom season in the spring, but also the fall is really beautiful. There's just, you know, the leaves, the autumnal leaves. We did a story that we ran in our March issue that focused on, it was, you know, Tokyo, Kyoto, and then the area around. There was a glamping retreat from Hoshinoya Hotels that opened near Mount Fuji. It was absolutely beautiful because we shot it in the fall, and the reds and the yellows and the golds were just absolutely spectacular. I think also people go skiing in Japan, and people might not realize that, but you know, the Niseko area is big for ski resorts, ski hotels, and also hot springs. So look, there's a lot of places to go. It's a big country.
Yeah, there's so much to see.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb super host. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
And you moved then from Japan to Saudi Arabia, is that right?
I did. I lived in Saudi Arabia when I was very, very young, in the early 80s.
So that's a destination that's put a lot of money behind driving tourism in the last couple of years, I've noticed. Is it a place that you could ever see yourself covering the magazine or that you would think would be of interest to tourists, or is it just too ethically contentious? Where do you kind of stand on it?
That's a good question. It's funny because we're talking about this. This is the second time this week that I've talked about it, this very topic.
Really?
I think it's very, look, there's a lot. Well, with travel being what it is right now, I don't know if we'll have to really go there at some point soon, but I think there is an ethics issue at hand. We all, you know, let's be clear. I also think that when you visit destinations, sometimes that is the only way forward. If there's cross-cultural exchange, that can actually end up being a net positive. You know, for our brand and where we stand when it comes to travel, it's very hard to say I'm only going to support places where I agree with the government. I mean, that's the reality. Governments change, things change. We have to always look at things with an open mind. There's no doubt that Saudi Arabia has issues. But I also think there's another side of the story, in that, you know, when you actually talk to people on the ground, there's a very different perception. That is really what travel is about. It's not about the average traveler talking to government leaders. It's about meeting people on the ground. And so I'm looking at things with clear eyes, but I'm also trying to look at them with hopeful eyes, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, totally. The campaigns that have been running here suggest that they have a kind of Grand Canyon-esque canyon that mm-hmm. is quite spectacular. Do you have any memories of traveling around there?
I don't have any memories of traveling around there. I mean, so when we lived in Saudi, we lived in a place called Yanbu. It was it was because of my father's work. So, you know, you lived on a relatively contained compound, but, you know, my mom would go to Jeddah or Riyadh, I actually posted a picture on Instagram of us there many years ago. She shared some pictures of me of the old town of Jeddah and sort of what it looked like. And I think what was actually very interesting is when we lived there, it wasn't quite as conservative as it is now. She obviously couldn't drive, but there were women had a little bit more freedom, at least as a Westerner, she did. But as a resident, as a visitor, then I would say things changed over the next 20 years. I do remember going to the Red Sea to experience the beach. I have some pictures of us there, and to go fishing and to go swimming. And there was actually a really kind of beautiful way of life, in that things were very simple. Mm-hmm. You could go shopping and, you know, and not have 20 million choices of things. And it was like, okay, this is the kind of cereal we're buying, 'cause this is what's available. Or, the entertainment was just seeing friends in a very sort of, in backyards, and that was that. And I think, and TV was very limited. So I know that that sounds strange, you know, now when you have a choice of everything, you sort of realize how little you actually really do need.
It's similar in a way to lockdown. Like,
yeah,
we've shed all the excess and life has become a lot more streamlined in a way.
Yeah, you don't need a lot. And I think that was sort of the thing that my mother and father got out of that experience, other than obviously making new friends and experiencing, you know, life in another country and meeting Saudis and making friends with them. But it was the sort of the understanding that, you know, in America, we're actually blessed to have so much choice, obviously freedom of expression, and it's a very different culture. But the flip side is actually sometimes there can be too much of that. And so when we were there, we kind of stripped it down to basics. And I was really little, but, you know, I learned how to swim. I learned how to read. I had great teachers. And I felt, you know, I, as a child, I didn't lack for anything. It just was a different life.
Mm, it'll be interesting to see how it evolves in the next few years when it comes to tourism.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how it evolves too. And I think, look, again, you try to come at things with an open heart and an open mind. I think having lived in Saudi Arabia and then Qatar, people in that part of that world are incredibly friendly, incredibly generous. And I wish that more Americans were able to visit and experience it.
Mm. Mm. So moving on to chapter two, that is the first place that you fell in love with. Where would that be?
The first place I fell in love with? That's a really good question. I would probably say Ireland. Mm-hmm. I've been to Ireland now 6 or 7 times, and that's where I got married. And, you know, there's a beauty to Ireland that I think, you can't underestimate how, again, friendly the people are, the greenery. I don't mind the rain. I think at the end of the day, you go to Ireland for the people, to stay up late in a pub, to you know, see this magnificent scenery and understand that, you know, there's a very strong, if you're American, there's a very strong connection for a lot of us whose ancestors came from Ireland. So when you go, there's oftentimes a heritage travel component, which, you know, up until now was a really big and booming part of the travel industry. So for me, you know, my grandmother was born there not that long ago in the grand scheme of things. She was born in 1908. Yeah. So I think a lot of times people go to sort of reconnect with their past. And at the same time, there's a lot of innovation and interesting things always happening in Dublin. And you know, there's a great, how do I put this? There's a great sort of culture of life to Ireland. People look at things, they're relentlessly optimistic and positive.
Yes. Yeah. And what part of Ireland did you get married in?
I got married on the West Coast. So that's where my grandmother was from. We got married at a hotel near Galway, and it was great. We had lots of friends fly in from the United States, and they made trips out of it, and they stayed in Ireland for quite some time. And I think they all came away feeling just thrilled that they were able to go. And, you know, for, again, from the East Coast, it's actually not that even that long of a flight. It's about the same distance as if you were flying to California, and sometimes even less if the tailwinds are in your favor. So for us to do a wedding in Ireland, although it seemed sort of like, wow, it's international, it really in a way was actually pretty easy and accessible.
Well, if Jackie's tempted you to visit the west coast of Ireland, one of the most magnificent places to stay there is Adair Manor. Picture a grand neo-Gothic castle in County Limerick on a sprawling 840-acre estate surrounded by medieval ruins, walled gardens and winding woodland paths, with a championship golf course, La Mer Spa and Michelin star restaurant too. It's the ultimate romantic escape, perfect for a staycation, moon, or in fact just any honeymoon, with its horse and carriage rides, wild river cruises, intimate cellar wine tastings, and just a total abundance of luxury at every corner. And they're now taking bookings for Christmas, a 3-night special itinerary of celebrations with whiskey tastings, extravagant dinners, and even a chauffeur service to the beautiful Adair Church to sing some carols. Oh, sounds wonderful, doesn't it? Head over to adairmanor.com to find out more and book your stay. Now, let's get back to Jackie Gifford. As an editor, has there been a particular feature written by one of your contributors that made you fall in love with a destination that you hadn't been to and then made you decide to book a trip to go there?
Oh, good question. Yeah, I mean, that happens pretty regularly for me. I find that I'll read a story and just go, oh my gosh, like I need to go. I would say this happened years ago, but a longtime contributor to Travel and Leisure, Maria Schallenberger, had written a story about Morocco and some of the desert camps there. And I then promptly booked a trip to go to go to Morocco. Within the next, I'd say, like, you know, 9 to 10 months, a year, I just started at Travel and Leisure. And I remember reading Maria's piece and just being like, you know, Morocco's always been on my list. I need to see it. And I went with my husband. We stayed in Marrakesh. We went to a beautiful hotel outside the city, outside in that, you know, in near Ouarzazate called Dar Ahlam, which is a relay chateau property where the owner, who's now, you know, he's created some really interesting concepts, including a roving hotel around the world. His name is Thierry. So Thierry had created this other, I believe it's called 700,000 hours, this roving hotel. But his one of his first projects was Dar Alam, and they'll create these dinner setups for you in the middle of the desert, in the middle of nowhere. And every night when you stay there, breakfast, lunch, and dinner is always in a different location. And it's just like it's like theater. And it was so interesting because the hotel is just in the middle of nowhere, frankly. And we drove to get there and through a snowstorm, and it was through a pass in the Atlas Mountains. And when we got to the hotel, it was just so special. And I think that was a good example of just dreaming about a place and saving up for it, you know, saving up for the trip because it wasn't inexpensive, and deciding to go And I was completely, and I wasn't, you know, at that time, I wasn't the editor in chief of Travel and Leisure, but I read a story and felt like I had to go and take action on it.
The power of great travel journalism.
Yeah.
So chapter 4 is your all-time favorite destination, which feels especially relevant given the August issue is your famous World's Best Awards edition, my favorite issue of the year. Yeah. So I thought maybe let's start with some of your world's best and then talk about some of the results that were in the magazine.
Sure.
I'm going to ask your all-time favorite city and then your all-time favorite hotel.
Okay. All-time favorite city is probably Paris. I think that that's a safe choice. I love Paris. My husband and I went there on our honeymoon. I think it's magical for all the reasons we know it to be. Food, wine, museums, culture, shopping, fashion, the walkability, the architecture, the sort of, you know, there's really no reason not to like Paris. Yeah. I've had some great nights there, staying up late, walking home, stayed at amazing hotels like the Maurice or the Shangri-La or the Park Hyatt, just, you know, some of these grand hotels. We were lucky enough to stay in the Maurice once where we had a beautiful room and it just felt like we were living a bit of history. And, you know, you walk outside and there are the Tuileries. I would say Paris. Mm-hmm. And my all-time favorite hotel. So I get asked this quite a lot and it's really hard to give an answer. I have to be honest because there are so many great ones and I have to say there's like a, you know, there's a hotel for every time in somebody's life as well.
Of course. Yeah.
So I think, you know, when you look back over the history of like where I've traveled, when I think about where I've traveled and where I've gone, it's the answer is never, it's ever changing for me. So if I had to say an all-time favorite hotel, and then I get myself in trouble because then people study these things. Well, I'll say this. So last year we stayed at Borgo Ignazia in Puglia with my son.
I've always wanted to go there.
The owner, Aldo Melpignano, is just the kindest man alive. And, you know, Borgo is a fantasy of an Italian village come to life. And it does feel in a way like theater in a good way. It is so, everything is immaculate. The food is incredible. The service is incredible. The sort of overall guest experience of being in Puglia, you know, the family has really put Puglia on the map for tourism because they were the ones who opened Masseria San Domenico many years ago. And, you know, for my son, who's still young, it was just so amazing how attentive they were to children. The Italians in general really love children. And so I think it was a great experience for us as a family. And I felt really, you know, lucky that we were able to go last year. The other hotel I will say, sorry, if I can have two, is the Gritti Palace in Venice, just because it's a piece of history. The art on the walls, the marble, the bar outside, you know, that overlooks the Grand Canal. I would say that those two Italian experiences are probably at the top of my list of hotels.
Gorgeous. And then I've got to push you for an all-time favorite overall destination too.
Well, Italy is certainly up there. I think, you know, we've as a family been going to Bermuda pretty regularly for the past 3 to 4 years, and it's very close to the East Coast. From New York, it's about a 2-hour flight, 90 minutes if you're lucky. And I think for us to feel at ease there in a really interesting way because it's so close. You land, the airport's, they're building a new airport for now. The airport, you know, it's small. You get outside right away and you're outdoors and you cross this causeway to go through the main island. And it's like, you know, you've landed in another planet. The water is this amazing blue. The beaches are absolutely stunning. My son learned to swim really in the ocean there. And I think the people are extraordinarily kind and generous of spirit. So I think Bermuda is probably one of our favorite places to go as a family.
And there's a heritage and a history there that people might not necessarily know. It's not that well known and popular for UK travelers, I'd say.
Which is surprising.
Yeah, because it feels so British. That's what's so amazing. I don't know how well you know English shops, but there's a Marks and Spencer's there. Which I when we were there, I found to be so amusing and lovely in a way that there was this little M&S, well, it, Marks and Sparks, as we like to call it. So, you know, it's got this real English heritage to it, doesn't it, that permeates throughout the island. It isn't just Caribbean in its feel.
Yeah, I know. It is. No, there's the British heritage is strong. So, you know, a lot of places still do tea, and there is a bit of a formality to the culture, but I think as a visitor, it's kind of, I mean, that's it is what it is. You go there for that. And I love going to Bermuda just to chill out. I feel like when we go, we end up having lovely dinners with friends, and the pressure to just be another person falls away, which I think is another great side of a travel. You know, sometimes you go to just not to really forget about your other life and have a break. And I think that's kind of why we've all fallen in love with Bermuda.
Mm. And so the world's best edition of the mag, can you first of all just tell us a bit about what it is, how the list is decided?
So it's a reader survey. So the readers vote on everything from their favorite hotels to islands, cities, cruise lines, tour operators. It's a very comprehensive survey of the best in travel. And we usually go live with the survey in around the first or second week of November, and it stays open through the beginning of March. And when the results come in, it's just a snapshot of what's trending in travel. And I think, you know, this year we did our 25th anniversary of World's Best, and it was really impressive because the survey closed, I would say, when people were just starting to get a handle on the coronavirus in the West, and it was, you know, things were shutting down, and people just were unclear of what the world was going to look like, what travel was going to look like. So I felt very strongly about moving forward with it because we knew, in your heart, you know, with the spirit of travel is still alive, and we needed to recognize and honor all those travel providers that had done amazing work, you know, just because
of course, the virus. You want to dream.
Yeah. You want to dream, and the virus doesn't negate all that work that they did. So when we got the results in, we said, you know, that we need to move forward. And our August issue, again, it was the 25th anniversary of World's Best. So we moved forward with the piece, and we had a resounding, really positive impact, I think, on the travel industry. I got lots of notes from people saying it came at just the right time. Some hotels were starting to reopen, so it was a boost. Some were still closed, mm-hmm. but it gave their team something to be proud of and look forward to. We did a lot of good work with that story. And I'm really proud of it. I hosted an Instagram live, and I, from my apartment, you know, we normally do a big party, and we couldn't do it. So obviously we did the best, that we could. And I invited some of our winners on, like the Minister of Tourism for Anguilla, and he came on Instagram Live with me. I had the GM from the Mark Hotel right here in New York City. They went for the best hotel in New York and then in the continental United States. They came on Instagram Live with me, and it was really fun, I have to say. You know, we're improvising like the best of them.
Yeah.
And it was a really great moment, I think, for the travel industry. The travel industry really needed it.
Yeah, exactly. They needed it, that bit of positivity.
Yeah.
I was really interested that the number one and number two cities were both in Mexico. Number one was Oaxaca, mm-hmm. number two, San Miguel de Allende. Mexico is obviously incredibly popular with your readers.
Yes, it is. I mean, look, let's be honest, it's close to home. It's always been one of the more popular destinations. Europe is has also always been a popular destination for our readers, really the number one, but followed closely by Mexico, because you have to remember Mexico is so culturally diverse. Every state has a different offering. And, you know, Oaxaca is really known for its food, its arts and crafts. And I think we're seeing a lot of people really love to travel for food. That was something that had been trending for a little bit. And then San Miguel is, you know, it's a jewel box of a city, the colonial era, the Spanish colonial architecture mixed with, you know, the indigenous culture and now really a thriving art scene. It's been popular for quite some time. So I was never surprised. San Miguel had actually won for the past few years as the best city in the world. And I was never surprised by that. It's just this year, Oaxaca overtook them by a few, you know, percentage points. But I think interestingly, you know, that's probably because of the food culture and people, I think, were really passionate about food and travel. So every year, you know, and then I've been at Travel and Leisure when Charleston, South Carolina won for the best city in the world. And I've been there when Kyoto has won for the best city in the world. And, you know, things change. But I do see a through line. Last year it was then 1 year it was Hoi An too. So, you know, people like cities with well-rounded experiences for them. And I mean that when you think about it, you don't just go there for one thing. They're going for art, culture, shopping, you know, the hotel scene. You know, sometimes it could be, again, a gastronomic capital. So I also think there's something to be said. A lot of these cities are actually very affordable to visit and they're closer to home. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, you take what you can and you glean from the results what you will.
Yeah. Well, I've added both of those to my travel wish list. Not been to Mexico yet. Looking forward to going sometime when we're able to travel again. Just so much to see, as you say. You could go back multiple times, I'm sure.
Exactly.
So let's move on to chapter 5. That is your hidden gem, a place that you love that maybe our listeners don't know that much about.
Well, I'll do another shout out for World's Best, because I still think it's hidden in the grand scheme of things. It's the island of Anguilla in the Caribbean. So a lot of people, they're in the Caribbean when you travel. If you've got to take multiple flights or connections, it's tricky. And so a lot of people are just turned off by that and they don't want to do it. So Anguilla, there was never a direct flight from the United States. And so oftentimes you'd fly to Puerto Rico and connect, or St. Martin and connect and take a ferry. I've been going there since 2007. And I think the beaches there are some of the best on the planet. They have 33 beaches, absolutely stunning. The visitor experience is just, you know, you really feel like you're secluded, isolated, tucked away from the rest of the world. It's never been a super touristy place. And I think what makes Anguilla so beautiful is it's very easy to get around. You get there, you rent a car, you drive to your beaches, you try the local restaurants. There's something really amazing about the warmth of spirit there. And I like it because not that many people go. The other great thing about it is it does win in our World's Best Award. So clearly, you know, the in-the-know travelers know about Anguilla, but I think, you know, it's never, just because of its size and the amount of hotels or, you know, accommodations they have, it's never going to reach a mass tourism, you know, standard, because it just can't. But I think, you know, a lot of people, I mention Anguilla and they're like, oh yeah, I know Anguilla. That's, you know, I've always wanted to go there. It's so beautiful. So that's one
and
of my
beautiful hotels.
And beautiful hotels, you know, Belmont Capdeluca. There's an amazing Four Seasons there, which you know, actually was originally a Viceroy. Now that Four Seasons took it over, they've really made it a beautiful product. And you know, Malihana has a long heritage. There's a great hotel called Zemi Beach House, which is up more on the northern end of the island. I think there's the people who go to Anguilla regularly really appreciate it and really love that they can go and again feel like they're not being watched, or it's just sort of like a, you know, there's no scene there. It's, I love St. Bart's, but there's a scene there, like where everyone's kind of watching each other and eyeing each other up to see what they're wearing. That's not Anguilla.
It's more easygoing.
I love St. Bart's, and I've been multiple times, and you go for that reason sometimes, but in Anguilla, you just don't have that vibe.
Oh, that sounds lovely. Oh, I should be somewhere like that right now.
Yeah.
In contrast, then, chapter 6 is the place that you would never go back to.
The place I would never go back to. Oh my gosh. That's a tough question. I don't know if I'd ever say that about one place. I guess in my heart of hearts, I want to give places second chances. At the end of the day, you know, ultimately, if you have a disappointing experience, maybe you might feel, you know, down the road, it might get better. But you know, I went to, it's funny you say that. I went to years ago, I was stopping on a destination. I was doing a cruise in the Baltic, and we stopped in Latvia and Riga, and it was okay. Mm-hmm. After I left, I was like, I'm not going to rush to get back there. And then I see that, and I actually commissioned a story on Latvia by a brilliant writer and Boris Fishman when I was at Travel and Leisure. And I go, okay, well, maybe I should, you know, based upon this piece, give it a second chance. Because I think I had visited probably too soon, and it was still, you know, there still wasn't this groundswell of creativity that he was able to tap into. So yeah, I guess like that was one place where I left being like, I don't know if I ever need to go back. And then I read this piece and I was like, well, you know, I never want to say never.
Yeah, yeah. And places, as you say, they evolve so quickly sometimes.
Exactly.
That your experience when you return could just be completely and utterly different.
Totally. That's it.
So we're on to the final chapter of your travel diaries. And that is chapter 7, which is the destination that is at the top of your travel bucket list.
Oof. I think right now, and this is inspired by a story that we ran in our June issue, it would probably be Rwanda, because I really want to go to see the gorillas, the mountain gorillas. And yeah, that's been on my list for some time. Akagera National Park, you know, there's now been, they've now successfully reintroduced the Big Five into some of the different parks there. And so I think Rwanda and also Kigali, I don't want to discount Kigali, because it's a thriving city and obviously been through trauma in the 90s. But I think people have come together in this very incredible way, you know, literally healed wounds from the wars. And I think anybody who goes as an outsider is always really moved by that story, by that experience, and really feels like, you know, they come out of it a changed person. Mm. The other place I guess I'd want to say I'd like to go is, you know, I love India. India is one of my favorite places, and I've always wanted to do Kerala and Goa, and frankly all these other incredible places in India. India is so vast, so I just to go back to India or to go to Varanasi, that's been on my list as well. I think when I can get back to India, as soon as I can get back, I'm gonna add that. You know, that's always on my list. It's always at the top of my list.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today, Jackie. It's been such a pleasure. Those were your travel diaries.
Thank you. This is so fun.
Thank you so much. That was Travel and Leisure's Jackie Gifford. Oh, I really hope you enjoyed all those wonderful destinations that she picked for her travel diaries. Travel and Leisure's new September issue honours the beauty of food and travel and is out now. If you can't get hold of a print copy, I always read it on my iPad. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, then please do subscribe, rate, and review. I'd love to hear from you. And come and find me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. Catch you next time for another episode of The Travel Diaries. To Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.